We'll start off our warm-up question today with a really, you know, kind of a very lighthearted question. The question is, are you living or dying? Are you living or dying? What's the score today? Are you living or dying? I'm going to give you 8 seconds to think about it and be brilliant. Are you living or are you dying? Living. How many of you are living today? Thank you. How many of you are dying today? My wife insists on both.
Depends on the time of day.
About what time do you start dying? After lunch. What I appreciate about this crowd is that it's always very spiritual. After lunch, we just die. I think I shared this in a sermon a couple months ago, but I was just going through a grind of really hard weeks recently, and I woke up one morning, and you know how sometimes God talks to you, and you kind of feel like, oh, well, that's the voice of God saying something to me. It wasn't like that. It was like my own spirit speaking to me. I don't know if that makes sense to you. But I don't know, sometimes I feel like I'm multiple people. Don't joke. Just stop. Cat, just no. There's a core of me that I think has a better sense for truth in life than kind of my waking brain a lot of times. Anyway, so I felt like my spirit, whatever that, you know, the core of me is, just sort of spoke to me loudly in the morning and said, Jordan, stop trying to save your life. It was just like that, and it struck me because there's quite a bit in the Bible, in the New Testament, among the Jesus teachings, where Jesus encourages his followers to lay down their life, right, to be willing to pick up their cross and follow Jesus daily, to pick up their instrument of execution, if you will, pick up their electric chair and follow Jesus daily. It's a rather lethal image, to be honest. And I was reflecting on a time I was living in Boston. I had managed to escape from Chicago, where we were with these Vineyard friends, where I'd had a very depressive season. I did some postdoc work at Harvard, but then it became clear that my academic career was not going to work out. And I was feeling very depressed about that. Some other things were going on. Sony and I had 7 straight miscarriages. I was feeling a bit low. And wrestling with God about this stuff, as one does, even us spiritual giants occasionally, you know, wrestle with the Lord during tough times. And I thought about these verses one day. I remember this very distinctly. It's like I was saying to the Lord, gosh, you know, Lord, I just feel like I want to die. I feel like it's too much. You know, I feel like I want to die. And the Lord kind of said to me, well, you know, why don't you? But sometimes when the Lord says something, it has a little extra content to it. And immediately I started reflecting on these verses, like, you know, he who seeks to save his life will lose it. He who loses his life will find it. And pick up your cross daily and follow me. Paul talked about being dead to the world and alive to Christ. And like, there are just tons of verses along those lines. What would it mean to live as a dead man was the question I asked myself. Keep in mind, I was very depressed. And I tend to talk grimly to myself when I'm depressed. What would it mean to really be dead to the world, to be dead to my ambitions, to be dead to my dreams, to be dead to what I imagine my future would be like, to be, you know, whatever. And just try to glorify Jesus and live for the next life and not this one. And it worked. I think it gave me some strength and, you know, it became sort of an enduring meditation in my life. Flash forward a few years later, and Sony and I had moved back to Hawaii. And I went to this retreat that was run by this very famous Christian counselor. I won't name the name, but sort of a guy who's famous for writing about healthy inner life and stuff for Christians. And so I went up to him on a break and I said, hey, you know, you're talking about all these concepts. Do you ever think about self-mortification, which is a fancy word that means self-dying, dying to yourself, self-mortification? And then I, in very brief terms, I described what had helped me get through my tough season that I was talking about. It's like, you know, really trying to mortify the flesh, to really die to myself in a very violent way. And I had done some things. I'd gone on long fasts and things to sort of mortify my flesh. And he looked at me, this eminent Christian counselor looked at me and said, "I've never even thought about such a thing." It's like, really? Because it's kind of the heart of the gospel in some way. Like, you know, Jesus, in every single gospel, Jesus teaches about this. He said, "No, I never even thought of such a thing." And then he paused and he said, "That doesn't sound healthy at all." I'm a bit of an egghead. I have way too much edumacation. And one of the things I really loved to do when I was in college is read some of the classic literatures, like Homer and Virgil, all these Latin poets. And so I don't remember much of those, but I remember one line in Latin from the Aeneid, this great epic poem about the founding of Rome. And it was from a battle scene where the pioneers of Rome are fighting off the natives, and they're vastly outnumbered, and it looks like they're just about to be crushed. And finally, the few soldiers that are fighting off this massive enemy army decide that, well, they're going to die. You know, there's nothing they can do. And then they start to act like it. And the line in Latin is, "Una solus victus nullum sperare salutam." Quote me on that, because it's going to make me sound really smart. It's like, it's pretty much the only line of Latin I know. "Una solus victus nullum sperare salutam." Does anybody know what that means? The only salvation of the lost is to not hope for salvation. The only hope for the lost, the only salvation for the lost is to not hope for salvation. The only hope for the lost is to not hope, is how it's translated sometimes. It's like, and what happens is that these soldiers who are fighting off this vast enemy horde against which they have no hope, they win because they start fighting in a way that's not trying to save their life, but it's just fighting. Right? So they're free. They're no longer protecting themselves. And they end up conquering this vast enemy horde. And Rome is founded. Yay! No, that was the... But that line always struck me because it sounds just a little bit like Jesus in a weird way. It's like, if you want to save your life, you have to lose your life. Right? You have to be willing to let go of the things that you thought gave you life, and instead live for eternity. There's a trade-off. There's a trade-off. And it's not fashionable to talk about that, right? It's not fashionable to stand up in front of a church on a fancy new stage and say, "Look, you all have to die. You have to pick up your electric chair daily if you want to follow Jesus. You have to be willing to lay it all down," as the song said. That sounds grim, right? That sounds like dying. Not living, what that is. But there's something that comes with it that's about, you know, you die to this life and you get to live to the next life. You die to rewards here and you get to stack up rewards there. This is the trade-off that Jesus talks about a lot. And of course, his living looked a lot like dying in some ways. He gave up all honorable position. He did without material possessions. He eventually got executed on a cross in humiliating fashion, etc. Do you buy it? Do you like that gospel? No. That gospel is interesting. Well, we're in the book of Revelation, which is an upbeat book. What the book of Revelation is, it's the last book of the Bible, and it's this epic prophetic book. It has all these visions recorded in it, and they're largely symbolic. They're about the battle of the age, and about how there is a reality behind the curtain, that there is a reality to this life that isn't immediately apparent to some humans. There is a spiritual, a supernatural part of life that a lot of humans tend to ignore. there is this life, and then there is a larger eternal realm that we're all really destined for. And the challenge is to live according to that eternal realm when we are existing in this very temporary realm. And then the bulk of the book of Revelation is about a form of salvation that Jesus, he speaks in Revelation, by the way, he describes as overcoming the world. That what you need to do is to overcome the whole world system. And it's like, it's a system. It's described in Revelation as a beast. It's got heads everywhere and tentacles everywhere. Like everything is worldly and it overwhelms you. And the message of the bulk of Revelation is, no, you have to overcome that. How do you overcome it? Well, you resist till the end. You are in the world, but you're not of the world. And there's a lot of talk of martyrdom. You resist the world until the point of death. The world is clever, it's deceptive, it's seductive. That's what the bulk of the book of Revelation is about. We are called to be overcomers, but we're called to overcome the world system by dying to it, and perhaps by dying, just full stop. Because particularly in the age when John was writing this book, receiving these revelations, Christians were being killed for sport in the streets of Rome. I mean, like literally. So it was a very grisly situation and would continue to be a super grisly situation for centuries and continues to be a grisly situation today. I mentioned last week, Christians are, for instance, being slaughtered by the thousands in Syria right now. It's like Christians have often gotten the tough end of things. And then at the end of the book of Revelation, there is a turn. We go from the call to Christians to overcome the world to the turn of history in which God judges the world. God destroys the world system. God overcomes the world system himself. How? By dying. Jesus died. And then Jesus is enthroned as sort of an authoritative judge. And suddenly the world system is no longer on the offensive, it's crumbling. And the very end of the book of Revelation is about a restoration of order, a restoration of the world, the new heaven, the new earth, the new Eden, in fact. So there's a plan to this, there is an arc to this. And we've entered the point in the book of Revelation in which the turn is happening. Now the world is no longer in ascendance. It is crumbling before us. And Christians have a role, not just in overcoming, but ultimately we have a role in reigning with Christ and restoring the world alongside him. So that's good. Yay. It's a little happier. So that's what we'll talk about today, and the next week we'll end the series. But point one should be remembered. We overcome the world by resisting it unto death. And by doing that, we become powerful. By doing that, we wield all the authority that Christ wields. That's the promise of the book of Revelation. And Jesus foresaw this, again, in his teaching. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will save it. Reign with me in heaven. That said, that's sort of the arc explanation. There are a few interesting prophecies in the book of Revelation, things that people try to interpret and argue about. We're going to look at one of those today from Revelation chapter 20. It has to do with the thousand-year reign of Christ. You guys know this one? Yeah. If you were alive in the 70s and listened to Christian radio, this is pretty much half of what they talked about. Like the end times and all right. So I'm going to read the first half of Revelation 20. And this is after the world system has been shattered by the victory of Christ, and the world is beginning to turn now. It's starting to head toward ultimate restoration, what it should be. And I saw an angel coming down out of heaven. This is John describing his wild vision. I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss. The abyss, we've discovered already, is kind of a prison. And holding in his hand a great chain, also speaks of a prison. He seizes the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil or Satan. John wanted to help you interpret that one. Make sure you know who the dragon is. and bound him for 1,000 years. 1,000 is a very symbolic number. It's 10 times 10 times 10. In other words, it's like it's a complete time. It might not literally be 1,000 years, but it's like, you know, there's a set period of time in which Satan will be bound. And he threw him into the abyss and locked and sealed it over him to keep him from deceiving the nations anymore until 1,000 years were ended. So Satan's authority is chained up. It's limited in a severe way. And as a result, the nations now are open to the influence of God. And after that, he must be set free for a short time. What? That's where it gets screwy. So like, there'll be this time where he's kind of bound up and Satan's influence is chained. But then at the end of that, it's going to get serious again. I saw thrones on which were seated those who had been given authority to judge. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony for Jesus and because of the word of God. So these martyrs are in places of judgment now. They're sort of judging alongside Jesus. They had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received his mark on their foreheads or their hands, so they stayed unpolluted by the world system. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. So for that period, these martyrs, these people who had resisted the world unto death, are kind of like co-kings and queens alongside Jesus. They get to wield Christ-like authority on the earth for whatever the time period is, the complete period of time. The rest of the dead did not come to life until 1,000 years were ended. But if you sacrificed your life for Jesus, you got to reign alongside him even during this time. And this is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy are those who have part in the first resurrection. The second death has no power over them. This is like the final judgment, the second death, when everybody gets judged and receives their eternal assignment. The second death has no power over these guys, but they will be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with him for 1,000 years. When 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog. That's sort of these peoples that represented the ends of the earth. So like the whole earth. About this battle before where Satan gathers all of his forces and they attack Jesus. They marched across the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of God's people, the city he loves. But fire came down from heaven and devoured them. Well, that didn't last long. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. We've already read about that. They will be tormented or punished day and night forever and ever, or for eons and eons is what it says, literally for ages and ages. All right, so it's my sermon for today. Thank you for following along so closely. So basically what this passage does, it sort of generally gives you the idea that eventually the world systems are going to collapse. And when that happens, things are going to be better for a while. And Jesus and his people, his martyrs, his army of the living dead. Wait, that didn't work. That's not my best line. But in a good way, this is not the zombie apocalypse. This is sort of the reign of the Christian martyrs. They're going to have influence over the earth for this time period. I don't know how long it is, but it's some big, you know, complete time period, it says. And then at the end of that time period, Satan will be loosed. And he might think it's being loosed like, oh, now I get to ride rough over the earth again, but actually he's just loosed to kind of meet his demise, right? It's like this final showdown that really isn't much of a showdown, and all it is like Satan gathers all the people who are loyal to him, who have been deceived, who really like the world better than they like Jesus, and they get the opportunity to vote at the end for the devil or for Christ. And evidently, quite a few people are going to vote for the devil, which is Sounds astonishing, doesn't it? Sounds astonishing. Sounds puzzling, but that's the prediction. That's the prophecy. And then right after that, the earth gets restored to beauty and order. Judgment happens, which is sad, but necessary. The question about this passage is, well, what is this 1,000 years? And when does it happen? And so there are three basic options that people talk about. I'll tell you what my favorite one is. And the first option is that people interpret this as sort of an iterative, repeated thing. That every once in a while, some beastly world system gains ascendancy, but it eventually collapses. It always collapses. You know what doesn't collapse? The kingdom of God on earth. People argue this because John is writing about Rome here, and Rome was literally killing Christians for sport when this was being written. But Rome collapsed. Rome was called the eternal kingdom. Yeah, it wasn't. It astonishes me today. Rome is, at least by some measures, the greatest empire the world has ever known. But today, not a single person speaks Latin as a functional language. Like, not only did Rome disappear, but its language vanished from the earth. That's just astonishing. Like, Rome is like was completely kaput. But the Christians continued to cover the whole earth, right? And after Rome, you know, it was someone else, and you know, all these empires. We used to hear the communists was an atheistic empire. Marx called religion the opiate of the masses, and it was the end of Christianity. Well, then that system collapsed. And you know what continues? The Christians continue, and we continue to go around the earth. So in retrospect, we read the history, but it was a heck of a prediction when he wrote it, because the Christians were this tiny, tiny persecuted minority being exterminated by the most powerful force the world had ever known. And yet the Christians won. And that's phenomenal. And they've continued to survive every massive worldly attempt to exterminate them over the last 2,000 years. It's like, come on, that's good. Right. That's amazing. It's the ultimate Cinderella story. And is unbelievable that it would work out. When this was written, it was a completely preposterous prediction. The fact that it came true should give every non-believer serious pause. It's just astonishing. The other popular interpretation of this 1,000-year thing is in the future that Christ is going to come back at a certain point and whisk some of us up to heaven, and there's going to be a 1,000-year sort of pseudo-heaven on earth for a while, and we don't know when it's going to happen. Could happen later this afternoon. Could happen before 2 o'clock, which would be great for Marianne. And then for some reason, at the end of the 1,000 years, Satan gets let out after this 1,000-year paradise on earth. I don't like that one too well because too many questions in it. Like, why that? Like, why would you establish paradise on earth and then let Satan out again at the end? It's like, what exactly is going on there? And then there's the final sort of interpretation, which is this 1,000-year reign, which is written in very symbolic language, is now. It's now because Christ has already achieved the victory. Yes? That's what the cross was about. And when Christ was walking the earth, he said to his disciples, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. In other words, his authority has been stripped from him. And when the disciples came back from ministering without Jesus the first time, like in Luke chapter 10, they said, Lord, Lord, even the demons submit to us in your name. Jesus, did you know that because we hang out with you, we now have authority over Satan and the demons? And Jesus was like, yeah, I know. Makes me very happy. Praise you, Father, but for showing this to little children like these guys. Right now, we have authority over Satan and his demons. So in a sense, right now, we are reigning with Christ. He will come again someday. We don't know exactly when. Even Jesus says he doesn't know. Only the Father knows the day and the hour, he says to the disciples in Acts 1. It might not seem like Satan is bound up because a lot of the world is still deceived, right? But But that's exactly what the prediction says. It says when Satan comes back after the 1,000 years, there'll be people from all over the world that vote for him. Now, how is that possible? Well, yes, it is confusing to those of us who believe in Christ and follow. But then again, maybe not, because all of us have a tough time in life. Life is challenging for all of us, and all of us are called to die, and some people don't like that very much. The people who vote for Jesus are the ones who, well, in this passage, they get beheaded, so there's that to look forward to. But it costs you something. What does it cost you? Well, I mean, it might literally cost you your life. Today, it's costing thousands of Christians their lives in different parts of the world. It may or may not cost you your physical life, but it will cost you something in life. To follow Jesus, you're going to have to pick up your cross daily. So it's going to be a bit of a slog. I kind of understand how, even though Jesus is ascendant right now, and he is, right? Because Christianity has spread around the globe. You know, it's difficult to find a nation in which there are not believers now. I'm not even sure there is one, except that some of the unreached smaller tribal nations. So, I don't know. Do you buy that? I'm not the final authority on these things, but that's what I think. I think that Satan is currently bound by Christ's authority in us. And if you've ever cast a demon out of somebody, you've experienced it in a very blatant way. Anyone who qualifies can wield Christ's authority on earth. How do you qualify? Well, anyone who resists the world to the point of death gets to wield Christ's authority and power on earth. So there you go. Are you living or dying? Well, yes. We're all doing a combination of the two, right? Might require a literal death, as I say, or it might require what the epistle writers call the living martyrdom. You might have to just live as though dead, which is what I contemplated back in my depressed Boston days. And there are lots of Christian counselors out there that say that's not even healthy. But I don't know, it was sure healthy for me. And every once in a while, my spirit rises up in me and says, Jordan, quit trying to save your life. You know that's just going to lead to trouble. You know, you were free. Who cut in on you? The first resurrection, then, is like being born again. Jesus talks about this. So do the epistle writers. I'm alive, but in fact, I died with Christ. And the me that is alive now is a different me. I'm paraphrasing Paul, but that's what he said. Anybody who's been born again, who's set aside their old life and adopted a new life, is like a judge on earth. Not that we're called to judge, but we're called to enforce Christ's victory on earth. Ultimately, you know, Christ comes back, and then there's like judgment for everyone. But those of us who have been martyred for Christ, we get to skip out of that, which is cool. Right? Because the second death, we've already died death for Christ here. We don't have to worry about it later. Well, we'll finish the series next week with a scene of the final judgment and the restoration of the new heaven and new earth and the new Eden. So it ends on a great note, actually. This time around, when Eden is restored on earth, or an Eden-esque type environment is restored on earth, those of us who have followed Christ and resisted the world to the point of death, well, we've been schooled in making better choices than Adam and Eve made. And that's really what life is about, you know? It's like they were presented with a choice in Garden of Eden. Tree of life? Why wouldn't you eat that? Tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Why would you eat that? Well, we did. Because we did not trust in the character of God. We were afraid he was going to make things hard for us. Therefore, he made things very hard for us. And we have to learn to trust him in the midst of that. That's my explanation for the nature of life on earth. We'll be talking about that a little bit today in the Explore class, by the way, which is the class that we run after second service for seekers and skeptics. All right. There's an application point I try to make every sermon, and this is an interesting one. Because it is clear throughout the book of Revelation, and particularly in this passage, that we humans get a certain amount of time to learn how to live well, but we also get a certain amount of time to learn how to die well. And what do you want to die for? Do you want to die for resisting the world, or do you want to die for resisting God? And we work that out in this life. It's a serious game. But if we're willing to die to this world, then we avoid what's called the second death. We'll read about that a lot next week. If we lose our life now, then we'll gain an extraordinary type of authority and an extraordinary type of life later. That's what it says. I guess the application point could be expressed like this. If you want to reign with Christ, you die for Christ. Easy peasy. Paul said to his protege Timothy in his second epistle to Timothy in chapter 2, he says, "For if we died with Christ, we'll also live with him. And if we endure, we'll also reign with him." This is a very common sort of thing for Paul to say to his disciples. Timothy, all you got to do, bro, is live as a dead man. That's all you got to do. And if you live as a dead man, you get to reign with Christ. Even the demons will submit to you. You know, the world will still try to kill you. Indeed, Paul got beheaded. Paul had probably already been beheaded by the time this was written. The world will still try to kill you, but you'll be reigning in heaven, so no big deal. So if you want to reign with Christ, you die for Christ. Are you motivated?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Have you not been listening? I feel compelled to share a little pro tip as someone who has been meditating on what it means to kind of live dead to the world but alive to Christ for a number of years now. As one who has been like saved from suicidality by the idea of living as a dead man. You understand, yeah? Here's my pro tip. One thing that makes it extra hard to die to the world, one of the things that makes it very hard to just let go of your dreams, your ambitions, whatever, and sort of live as a dead person, you following? One of the things that makes that extra hard in this world is that you look around you and it seems like many other Christians don't have to die. Right? Not make it hard. So you get yourself psyched up and you're like, yes, I will lay that down. I will lay down my career ambitions. I will lay down my material ambitions. I'll be generous. I will lay down this relationship. I will lay, you know, whatever. It's like, I will make that sacrifice. And then you look at the brother or sister next to you and you see, like, they seem awfully happy. They seem disturbingly comfortable. They have a nice job. They have a nice relationship. Their kids are so perfect. Everything turns out well for that Christian. And I'm just crawling through the muck, gasping for breath. That's what makes it hard. That's what makes it hard. Makes it extra hard for me. And you know how it works, guys. The Christians who don't look like they're dying, they don't feel that there's anything wrong with it. You know, they just say, oh, we're just blessed by God. And you're like, well, what about me then? Right? Because I'm struggling. Am I not blessed by God? Am I not loved by God? I'm just painting that picture because that's the struggle. Am I right? That's the struggle. You look around and say, I feel like my death is unjust by comparison. That's what kills you. And in my experience, that's the main thing to which I must die. Thou shalt not covet.
That's right.
That's the main death for me. That's the main death for me. And it's really hard, you know, because you feel singled out by God for struggle, and then you feel unloved by God, and then the world comes to you and says, does it have to be that hard? And that's all the world has to say to most people. To most people, that's the only thing the world has to say. It's like, I could make this slightly easier for you. Are you in? What would it hurt? I mean, come on, what would it hurt? And that's how the world gets you, because again, what we've learned in the book of Revelation is that the world does not come across as a murderer. The world comes across as seductive, as a party girl, as beautiful and intoxicating. That's the struggle. That's the struggle. And that's the first struggle that we see Jesus fight in the gospel. Satan comes to him and says, look, we could make this easier. I'll give you the whole world if you just bow down to me. If you just cooperate and do it my way, you can run this whole thing. That was the temptation in the wilderness. And Jesus said, no, thou shalt worship God and him only. It's a tough one. It's a tough one. But when you get it right, it shows. I can see it in your eyes. I see. It's like looking at a war veteran, you know, someone who's been through it and is not going to shake. It's an amazing thing when you get there. That's the end of that. I'll pray here in a second, and you should all think about things that you need to die to. I need to die to this picture of my future. I need to die to this desire. I need to die to this appetite. I need to die to this habit. I need to die to this relationship, whatever it is. But in all cases, I'm just encouraging you as a fellow traveler, as one who has walked the walk, get it straight in your head that comparison is what kills you. Comparison is what's going to make it hard. Right? So you can identify the thing you got to let go of, but just get it straight that comparison is the thing that's going to make it hard for you to let go of it. Is that clear?